Hey, Patrick, this is Mia calling. I really appreciate your podcast. I really love your interviews, despite them being difficult and sometimes heartbreaking, usually heartbreaking. But the most recent one that I just listened to, with Tada, made me think about another question that has been coming up a lot for me around white supremacy and bodies of women and the culture and the disembodied head from a traumatized body of a body that the culture has communicated to that person that is always that their body has always been too big, too fat, too and this is, I think, where how eating disorders or disordered eating comes into it. And when you and Tada were talking about disordered behavior, you didn't really get into it. The conversation went in the direction of dance and not so much in the direction of eating. And I just wonder if you've ever seen the work of Virgie Tovar, V-I-R-G-I-E, last name T-O-V-A-R. She's this radical feminist who talks a lot about how capitalism and white supremacy are essentially, you know, tools of white supremacy to oppress and suffocate the minds and the spirit of women. And also Sabrina Strings wrote a really interesting book called Fearing the Black Body, the racial origins of fat phobia. Anyway, just a couple thoughts. I just really appreciate everything you do, and I just wanted to put those out there as possible interviews maybe in the future or threads that perhaps you could follow. I'd be really interesting to hear your thoughts on these issues. Thanks. Bye.
First of all, Mia, thank you very much for that message. Thank you for the recommendation. Thank you for what you said. I really appreciate the kindness and for your support in listening to this podcast. And yeah, that interview with Tada, definitely we talked about dance and the colonized body and whiteness. And we did go in that direction talking more about dance specifically. And we did touch on very, very briefly, we didn't go into it, but we did touch on eating disorders just barely. And that's, of course, what you talked about in that message. And that's definitely a thread that I want to follow, talking about the effects of colonization on the body, the disconnection, the dissociation that comes from it. So thank you so much, Mia. I really appreciate the recommendation and the kind words. And if anybody else wants to do what Mia did, which is leave me a voicemail, which I can feature on the podcast, or not, if you just want to send me a message, just let me know what your intention is with that. But yeah, if you'd like to do that as well, you can call the phone number 208-918-2837. And before we move on with this episode, I have one more announcement to make, one more thing I need to say, which is I was asked to participate in an AMA and Ask Me Anything on the Collapse subreddit. I was invited by one of the moderators, and I'm very excited to do it, and it seems appropriate that I would be asked to do it. Of all the places that I could be asked on Reddit to do an AMA, the Collapse subreddit is definitely the place for it. Thanks to Mike for inviting me on to do that, and that'll be on this Friday on the 15th, January 15th. Should be starting around 11 a.m. Mountain Time, and I'll be announcing that on the day of on my social media. I'll be putting a link to the Collapse subreddit down in the description of this episode as well. The URL for that is reddit.com/r/collapse. And yeah, here's the episode.
How do we transition an extractive economy into a regenerative economy? How do we do that? And this is a question that every place on earth needs to answer for themselves.
Right.
And so this Bodhichara Regeneration Fund is a way of creating a transition pathway for an economy to change over. And it's sort of a big thing to say that. That's a very big deal. It's very complex. The other part of this is that we need a way of organizing the territory so that it can evolve itself into a regenerative economy. Mm-hmm. And that's mostly about learning. That's mostly about education. How do the people living here learn how to be this way?
In this episode, I speak with Joe Brewer. Joe is a change strategist, complexity researcher, and cognitive scientist. He has a background in physics, mathematics, philosophy, atmospheric science, complexity research, and cognitive linguistics. This is the fourth interview that I've conducted with Joe, probably over the past, couple years. I think the first time I spoke with him was probably a little over 2 years ago. He's somebody that I like to track and just to see what he and his family are up to. They've been on one hell of an adventure since I spoke to them, what was it again, 2 years ago or so. Joe is somebody that I really admire. The kind of work that he's doing is incredibly important. It's very necessary and very needed right now, which is working to build regenerative cultures, to really begin the work of creating networks of people around the world to find your home and then begin to do very intentional, very well thought out land restoration, really understanding the bioregions that you're in and working to regenerate the land, which in turn will help regenerate the earth. This, of course, is not meant to be too hopey or we're going to save the planet. It's not really like that. It's more of just this is where we're at. We have crossed numerous planetary thresholds. Industrial civilization in particular has done a real number on the living systems of this planet. And I think all of us, if we were just to look around with any amount of clarity and honesty, can see just how much devastation has been wrought in the wake of the expansion of industrialization globally. When Joe and I spoke last, it was last year. It was right around when the pandemic started. And the last thing we really talked about was very, I feel like a lot of our interviews are very meta. Like we talk about things on a very planetary level scale. And in this interview, what I really wanted to do is just focus in on exactly what Joe is doing, where he and his family currently live, which is Barichara, Colombia. Him and his family settled there. Oh, how long has it been now? About a year or more, I think. Digging their heels in and doing very important and very beautiful sacred work of regenerating the land, of restoring the land there and working with the people there to create a much more ecologically conscious or ecologically centered culture. Basically preparing the way for what is inevitably going to happen, which is a planetary scale collapse, both environmentally as well as socioeconomically, politically, and all of that. I think anybody here in the United States can definitely understand that we are in the belly of the beast, and with the events that have happened just in the past week since I started recording this introduction here on the 11th of January, of course, I'm referencing what happened on January 6th. We're in the middle of a collapse, of a decline. One of the most powerful empires that has ever existed is eating itself alive, which is a fairly predictable outcome. So Joe and his family saw this a long time ago. They saw what was happening. They saw where it was leading. And they got out of the United States. And they decided to go down to South America and begin to do this really, really important work, I would say. Which is exactly why I continue to track Joe's work. So yeah, that's what this interview really touches on more than anything. We kind of stay away from the meta perspective, the meta analysis of the global situation. And we really just hone in on what exactly Joe is doing in Barichara and the kind of land restoration projects that he's engaged in. We also discuss his recently released book that was published on the Earth Regenerators website, The Design Pathway, which you can read for free. It's a really excellent book. I really recommend that people check that out, and I'll be putting a link to the Earth Regenerators website as well as a link to that book. And we also discuss the Barichara Regeneration Fund that Joe has started and the way in which he's being very transparent and how the funds are going to be allocated to help build a regenerative culture in this very specific bioregion and helping create networks which are already developed, which have already begun to form already, a network of people around the world that are engaging in these kind of regenerative culture building practices. And this really, I mean, and in the bigger scale, planetary scale of all of this is that, I mean, this collapse, this decline that we're in the midst of currently is not going to slow down. It is going to continue. And we need to really consider not only how we're going to build resiliency in this time, but also how we can engage in regenerative practices. Because in spite of everything that we should know at this point about the direction we're going and some of the inevitabilities of it all, it's still incredibly necessary and important that we engage in regenerative practices. We need to learn how to live this way. And it's really difficult because we've been encultured in a society that is not regenerative at all. It is destructive. It is toxic. And so to learn how to live in this way is a really big step, but it's nonetheless very needed and very important. And I think Joe is one of these individuals kind of leading the way in demonstrating how that can be done. Also, just something I want to say is that Joe's daughter makes several appearances in this interview. We actually did this interview over Zoom and we could see each other while we were doing it. So I will release a little bit of video from this interview as well, but she makes an appearance a few times and it was really actually very sweet. And I'm really happy that she did make an appearance during the interview. That's all I've really got as far as introducing this interview. I will be putting all of the resources to Joe's work, the Earth Regenerators website, the Design Pathway, his new book, as well as the Bodhichara Regeneration Fund, which I think people should really support. With everything going on, I have to admit, like right now, here in the United States, this interview, it feels even more precious or meaningful just because I've been going through a bit of this emotional roller coaster the whole year, just in the past week or two, it's been very emotional just seeing where everything is going and getting a glimpse into how Joe is living so closely with the land, how he is such a sweet father, how he talks with his daughter, how he just to know that he's there, you know, that he's out there and that there are these people doing this. I think it was a previous interview we had done where we talked about it being invisible sacred work. As he states in this interview, this work has become far more visible now because I think it's time. I think it's time that people really see this. And I find that these types of conversations with people like Joe are really just, it's medicine. It's medicine for me, and I really hope it's medicine for you too. If you would like to learn more about my podcast specifically, you can go to my website, lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be there. If you would like to support my work monetarily, there's a couple options available. The first option is through a one-time donation through PayPal. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast, or you can do it through Venmo, and my handle on Venmo is @lastbornpodcast. So consider doing that. Those donations are very, very helpful. And if you'd like to support this work on a monthly basis, on a regular basis, you can do that through Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/lastbornthewilderness. And by becoming a patron, you'll gain early access to these interviews before they are released publicly. Anyway, that is all I got, everybody. Thank you so much for your support. Without any further delay, here is my interview with Joe Brewer. Yeah, and we were just talking about just last time we spoke was near the beginning of at least when the pandemic was hitting. I mean, here I'm in the United States, and of course it hits North and South America around the same time, I assume, but we were just sort of discussing how this sort of is situated within a broader collapse on a planetary scale, and this is just sort of stuff that we can kind of expect to happen more and more as things kind of deteriorate within industrial civilization itself as it kind of buckles under the weight of all of its contradictions and just the demands that it has on the environment and everything. So I remember that last discussion we had was just very, like, you helped me because I think I was feeling really anxious and panicky almost about what was going to happen. And I think you helped frame it in a much healthier way. Hi, how are you?
Yep, Elise is coming by to say hello.
Hello, Elise.
She wants her to...
I love seeing like your family on social media and just seeing how you're all doing where you're at. And it's good to see her. Hi.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of the really powerful things for us about the pandemic was how healthy it was for us to be in this mountain village in a remote place.
Mm-hmm.
And after an extended drought, when there was serious water scarcity, it started to rain in April. And then we got 6 months of not continuous, but 6 months of an extended period where it was never really very dry.
Mm-hmm.
And we watched the landscape green and come to life. And a lot of our work was water retention. So we were taking pickaxes when it would rain. I did this again just 3 days ago. I got up at 3 o'clock in the morning when I heard the heavy rain start, grabbed a flashlight and my raincoat and a pickaxe. And there's this community reforestation project that our house is a 2-minute walk from, and we do a lot of work there. And so, yeah, there's no really good way to estimate how much water we helped absorb into the aquifers and the ground. But it seems reasonable that for every big rain event, so there were probably 30 of them, for each big rain event, we probably helped 30,000 or 40,000 liters of water to go into the ground.
Wow.
It would otherwise run off as just erosion and running off into the river.
Hmm.
So it was very significant.
Yeah.
And so I had this connection to something real and something meaningful while a lot of people were stuck in their apartments in the city and just really miserable.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not in a big city by any means, but that's been my experience personally. It's been pretty isolated in a house. You know, I'm not doing a lot, you know, I'm really doing a lot of this kind of work, which is interviewing people and releasing podcasts and stuff like that. But yeah, I kind of live a little vicariously through you a little bit online, just seeing what you're up to. It's like, all right, Joe's still at it. This is beautiful. I'm so happy to see that you're out there and doing this. And yeah.
Well, do we light the candles after it gets dark? It's still light out. Yeah, today is the full moon.
Mm-hmm.
Or tonight at 10:28 p.m. here in Bogota time. It's going to be the full moon. And we started a practice 3 months ago that during the day of the full moon, we do, we make a gift offering to the moon.
Mm.
What they call here in Latin America, they call pagamentos, sort of payments.
Mm.
But really better to call them offerings of gratitude to the Mother Earth. And we make some music and sit outside under the moon. And very simple, but the idea is that the children learn that the cycle of the moon is something that is meaningful,
mm-hmm.
that we have a regular activity for, and that afterwards we go back to someone's house and play some music and dance a little bit.
Nice.
It's a way to connect to a very important cycle that, you know, for a long time we forgot to connect to.
Yeah, for sure. That's a good thing to instill in younger generations. And I just imagine, you know, you and your wife are raising your daughter in such a unique way that, I mean, it's, I don't know. I can't even imagine like the, I don't know. I just think about my childhood and how disconnected I've been. Like, it's been a whole life process for me to kind of find these connections to, I don't know, like connection, like I still don't feel it personally speaking, but like I've definitely navigated it better than I have in the past, which is just understanding where this disconnection comes from the land and like the cycles of the earth and, you know, disconnection from my own body and what my body's trying to tell me when I just don't understand what's happening. Like that's been a whole, like I'm 31 and I'm starting to kind of figure that out. Like, I'm just starting to, like, get my, like, oh, okay, I get where the roots are. Now, how do I proceed with that? You know, I can tell that you've been on this journey and you're trying to instill that in your child. You know, you're raising her in a very particular way, which is incredibly beautiful.
Yeah. What's really, what feels super important, and it was like a philosophical or an ethical principle for us a couple of years ago. And now it's not exactly a daily rhythm, but it's definitely integrated into our daily lives in general. And that is that we know how important it is for children to just think it's normal. Mm-hmm. You know, like my daughter thinks it's normal that when it rains, of course, dad just grabs his pickaxe and goes out and gets muddy and comes back in all wet because the trees need the water.
Right.
You know, and it's so obvious to say that. And you know, our daughter knows that when the trees start to release their seeds, that we collect them and mm-hmm. we organize them at the house mm-hmm. and we put them on shelves and we then figure out how to put them into seed trays, you know, because there are different natural, like ecological processes for each type of seed. Mm-hmm. For example, some seeds have to go through the intestinal tract of an animal, which scrapes the outer shell, which helps it to begin germinating. And so if it doesn't have the animal to do that work, then you have to scrape it with a rock or something like this. Mm. So each tree will only be born from its seeds if we learn how nature does it. Mm-hmm. And she's just learning this, and it's normal.
Yeah.
So there's something very simple and elegant.
Yeah.
And yet, at the same time, something so alien to the modern world, because one of the key ideas of really the Western philosophical tradition and its various incarnations is the idea that humans are separate from nature. And because nature is full of gods and spirits and powerful forces, that it's scary.
Yeah.
The wilderness is scary. Think of the Brothers Grimm and all of those fairy tales that tell us how dangerous it is to wander into the forest at night.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to go into the community forest tonight after dark. I mean, around 8 p.m., but after dark. And we're going to make music and dance because of the full moon. So our daughter is going to have none of that fear. Like, it was never put in her. It never has to be taken out.
Do you like, read those grim fairy tales to her just to see how she reacts to those kind of themes at all? Like, because I've had friends who, you know, grew up Christian, very religious, you know, the Bible was a big part of their upbringing, right? And then they leave that behind, and then they may have a child, and they raise their child, and they're like not raising them in that faith or that belief system. And then they like read Bible stories to them, and the kids pick up on things that, you know, you wouldn't have picked on because you were so, you know, born into such a particular environment where those type of questions may not be even allowed to be spoken, right? Do you have that experience at all with Elise? Like, does she come up with things or ask questions or say things that you're just like, oh, like, you know, that just never would have come up otherwise unless we raised her in this particular way?
It's hard to know because, as every parent will tell you, kids that are our daughter's age, you know, she's turning 4 in about 2 weeks. Mm. So she's in the 3-year-old, 4-year-old range. There's that saying, you know, kids say the darndest things. and it's really true. Like, children are just so beautifully innocent and incredibly creative as they're learning how to construct more complex thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
That it's really hard to say. Okay. We don't expose Elise to what I might just call the normalcy of colonial history.
Mm.
Like, we don't specifically conceal it. We don't specifically paint something else over it to hide it. But like, our daughter's best friend watches a lot of Disney movies.
Mm.
and is all about princesses. And now Elise is all about princesses. And we just ask them, as you know, four-year-old girls, what do you know what a princess is? No. Well, what does a princess do? They dance. Oh, that's it. That's a princess.
Right.
And you know, and you can see that they're just absorbing these ideas without really understanding them. And what's different about that, which is this sort of manipulative programming, contrast that with what happens now that our daughter, like last week, we went up into the community forest, the Beale Parque, and there are these, there's a type of large caterpillar that makes a butterfly, and there are a lot of them that live on a specific bush. They, you know, they come in pulses of hundreds of them at a time, eating all the leaves of these bushes. And so we were up there, and someone had put poison on the leaves to kill off some of these caterpillars, which we never see poison being used in the Beale Parque, so we were surprised by it. But what Elise saw was 50 or 60 dead caterpillars that were laying on the trail and being eaten by the ants. And her reaction was, she was upset about it and she was sad about it, but she had an impressive capacity for a child who's just under four to understand that they were dead, to understand that it was good that they were food for the ants, to be sad that they were dead and asking why and what happened, and just really trying to understand them, because she picks up and plays with these caterpillars, and she talks to these caterpillars, and they're her friends, and she wants to know what happened to them. And of course, 3 or 4 days later, there was another pulse of caterpillars, and there was, you know, back to business, because there were so many of them. So what I find interesting about her reaction was its complexity. That she had an ecological understanding for a lot of what was going on. She recognized the part that wasn't normal. It's not normal for all the caterpillars to be dead and dissolving on the ground. And it's not normal to be for there to be some white powder on the leaves. And so she was being like a little detective. And she could hold the beauty and love for these animals while also being sad and grieving for them, while also understanding that they were food for other animals, all in the same moment.
Right.
And I just thought about, in that moment, like, a lot of kids think caterpillars are yucky and would be scared to touch one. A lot of kids in general would either find death fascinating and cool, or find it really sad, but have a hard time finding this blend at such a young age.
Right.
And very few would have an understanding of the ecological significance that the ants had food.
Right.
That the ants were eating them. And so it's hard to say, right? Like, I look at a situation like that, and what I see is familiarity. And I think that's the thing, is we've been around this ecosystem enough in the last year that it's just very familiar.
Right.
And so details are very clear. And if something changes, it's a detail that's recognized. And you know, children are very good observers, so they definitely get details. But it was more like the emotional handling of the situation is what I found so interesting.
Yeah, that is really interesting. She's able to have a complex almost set of emotions and process it and understand what was going on, you know. That seems to be, that's really important, I think, as far as developing. I mean, that being able to do that. Yeah, you're just, as far as people I know, I mean, in my life, you're definitely one of the more unique people that I've kept up with and have talked to as far as this. So I don't know many people that move to Colombia to engage in regenerative, you know, building cultures regeneratively and working with the land like that and, you know, raising a family simultaneously. So it's like, you know, I'm just kind of trying to get a little window, little peek into that existence that you have there.
Well, yeah, one of the things that's really interesting about the way that we're living now is I feel like in a way we got in a boat and left the land we're from, and then got off of the boat in some other land, except it's metaphorical for a culture or a more like a worldview. We are not in the world of being afraid of unsustainable civilization collapse. which we were when we lived in a city and we felt the danger of it.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, in the world of giving birth to a forest.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we're in the world of the future.
Mm.
Like we're in a more primitive or more ancestral kind of a world. But this more ancestral world is a world of the future, not of the past. So we're doing things like collecting seeds, thinking that someday there'll be old trees, probably long after we're dead.
Mm-hmm.
And being in this place, I just don't have the stress about what's going on in the world. Like the U.S. elections came and went, and I was sad for all my friends who were caught up in it. What a massive distraction
mm-hmm.
from what's important. And
yeah.
and it's a distraction because that whole system is dead.
Yeah.
That whole system. There's nothing about that system that can survive its own self-destruction.
Yeah.
Even though a lot of people are actively suffering in it, and it's terrible, there's nothing that can be done to save it. It's terminal.
Yeah, it definitely feels like I'm inside of a body that is dead or dying, and it feels like... I don't know how do we even articulate it. Just feels dead.
Yeah, well, if you want to tell him something, go ahead. What do you want to tell him?
Hey, Elise.
His name's Patrick. What do you want to say? Go ahead, Elise. What do you want to say?
I wanted to say that what's his name?
Oh, you want to ask him his name?
Oh.
Oh, I'm sorry. You can still ask him his name if you want to. You can ask him what his middle name is, since I told you his first name.
Ooh.
You want to try that? Go ahead and ask him.
What is your middle name?
What is my middle name? My middle name is Edwin.
Edwin? What a beautiful middle name.
That's my grandfather's name.
What's your middle name, Elise? Do you want to say it in English or Spanish?
Ellie.
Now, Ellie is your preferred nickname. But what is your middle name? The one you get from your grandmothers. Remember? Yeah, you just don't want to say. Your middle name is Rosemary. Because my mama was Rose.
No, I'm not named Rose.
You're not named Rosemary. Oh, okay. Well, Ellie is a beautiful name.
Ellie.
Just like Edwin is a beautiful name.
Rosemary, is that right?
Rosemary. Because Mary is mama's mama. And my mama's name is Rose. So it's Rose and Mary.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And also it's rosemary, a wonderful herb to eat. Yum, yum, yum.
Yeah. Everybody knows my middle name now. That's my middle name, everybody. Yeah. It's an old one. It's an old name. I don't hear it very often anymore. It's one of those names that kind of went away the past couple generations a little bit, but... anyway, it was funny when she came in, I was just basically saying that being in the United States feels like I'm in a dying body, which is a stressful feeling. Cause I think the thing is that's why I really like living, I guess you could say, vicariously through you and what I'm seeing you do is because I know the experience now a little bit of what it's like to leave the body of the United States. And I'm thinking, and I think more about cultures in that way now. I don't think of it as this like abstract idea as much as it's like an actual living thing that we are, and it's like living through us, you know? And so like there was a very unique feeling I had like every time I've left the United States of like feeling like my actual physical body was leaving a space and a body. And I didn't know how to articulate it until more recently. And I was like, there's just this very distinct feeling. And it was it's such a relief that comes up when you go somewhere else that isn't the United States, because it's such a dysfunctional and anxiety-inducing place to exist in. And particularly around like you're talking about the election and all that. I mean, it was like very fucking stressful. Sorry, but like, it was just really stressful. And even me, like being on the same page as you, I understand what you're saying, like in the bigger scheme of it all, this is just the last dying gasps of a civilization. And I can feel that. And I know that, but it was just such a stressful time. So I too got caught up in that, you know, and I talk about it on the podcast a lot, but it's like, I feel like this, like living on this planet, living in this time is like, there's so many worlds that are existing simultaneously. And like you said, like you can like leave the U.S. and start doing what you're doing in Colombia. I'm going to say the name correctly. Baricara?
Barichara.
Barichara. Okay, thank you. You know, being there, like, that's a different dimension almost that you're existing in. You know, it's just like, So I just had a comment on that. It's just, it's really hard when you're in the middle of it to, like, leave and, just talk about it in a way that acknowledges the, I don't know, just how there is this like multi-level thing happening here, and it's hard not to, hard to remember that. I forget that all the time.
Yeah, and what I'm finding really interesting about the rhythm, we're in a temporal rhythm with our bodies and our daily routines that is letting us become clear on larger things that we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So a year ago, I would have said something abstract like, I want to help with a large-scale landscape regeneration project, and my wife wants to help create a food forest. Mm-hmm. And we said this last year. And one thing that's become much clearer for me now that we're here is I'm walking, like literally walking on the landscape, in the patterns of connectivity. Oh, thank you, Elise. Oh, that looks yummy.
I'm sharing it.
Wow, it's delicious. Thank you. And so, like, one of the things that I was invited to do in the last 6 months was there's this area of the territory called El Caucho, which is a ridge line that's 5 kilometers long. So it's, you know, a little more than 2 miles. And it goes from the town of Barichara, and it's more uphill from here to the nearby town of Villanueva. And this ridgeline contains a system of aquifers that provide the groundwater for the towns. And the two towns together have about 10,000 people in them. And what's interesting is I was invited into several people's private land to walk the land with them and visit some of the wellsprings, or what they call here nacimientos del agua, birthplaces of water, where the water comes out of the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so during the 6 months, I visited 11 nacimientos del agua in El Caucho. So 11 wellsprings. 3 of them have water and 8 of them are dry. And so I can feel the connectivity to where the water system, subterranean water system, is broken.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in a stretch of land that you can walk from one end to another, you know, 2 miles in about an hour, maybe an hour and a half, because it's a stone path hiking trail.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a little rough at times, you know, so it's not a fast, brisk walk. But, you know, within an hour and a half, you can walk completely from one end to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very interesting to go from, you know, something generic like, I want to participate in a large-scale landscape regeneration project, to now I can say, I have visited 11 sacred points of contact on the land where my body tells me the indigenous people used to give ceremonies here,
mm-hmm,
to these wellsprings, and they would walk them. And these wellsprings are part of little like tributaries, drainage basins that connect to the river that runs across the larger plateau that this ridgeline is on the edge of. And so I can feel this river, this dead river that I want to help bring back to life, has about 15 tributaries. And 7 of them are in El Caucho, half.
Mm.
So half of regenerating this river is reforesting this 2 mile long line of ridgeline. Well, that feels doable, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's, you could walk it in a little more than an hour. And, you know, from one end to the other. And it's a place where the land itself tells you where it needs help, because you can see where the water moves and see the shape of the land. And so there's something really different now about what we're doing. And that is, we are placing our bodies, and therefore our minds and our awareness and our dreaming and imagining, into these very intimate places.
Yeah.
And it's allowing us to receive what I might call messages or stories from the land. And so we're now in this place where we can have that level of intimacy, which is really powerful. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing was I started negotiating to buy some land in August because, that's funny, we didn't even have the money, but I started negotiating because we visited this piece of degraded land. And it's at the very top of this aquifer system at the highest point of this ridgeline. And it's for sale, 3 hectares of land. I took pictures while I was there, posted on Facebook and said, I would love to decolonize and regenerate this land. And without even specifically asking for it, I was given $10,000 in donations in 24 hours
wow.
to help buy the land. Which then meant we needed to go talk to the owners and start a dialogue. And we still haven't bought the land yet. And we're now looking at a, you know, a more sophisticated understanding of the situation and everything. But mm-hmm. but what's interesting is as I started looking at, you know, I told people if we bought this land, we'd set up a land trust, which is a legal model that exists in North America and in Europe or in several European countries. And so I was like, let's create a land trust. But I didn't know the legal form for a land trust mm-hmm. in Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to start looking. And as I started looking, I eventually, after about 2 months, discovered, you know, I didn't know the name to look for. And when I try to translate, say, it's a land trust, but what do you call it in Colombian Spanish? I don't know. So, you know, I didn't know what to call it. And then eventually I found that there's this legal model, this legal tool that's called a Reserva Natural Sociedad Civil, a civil society nature reserve, because the public nature reserves are the national parks.
Mm.
And a civil society, so they created the framework for national parks and a constitutional change in 1993 when Colombia created its Ministry of Environment.
Mm.
And with this, they created the network of national parks and then said, we want to encourage sustainable development. And talk about how far ahead they are of the United States. In 1993, we want a way for people to do sustainable development on their own land. So we're going to give them a version of this nature reserve for civil society.
Hmm.
There's one for the government and public land, and there's one for civil society. And the civil society nature reserve basically says, if you own land, you can get tax exemptions. You don't pay any property taxes. So basically your land becomes like a nonprofit through a contract that you have with the national government.
Mm-hmm.
And this contract says you agree to a set of ecological conservation goals, but you can develop business activities that don't conflict with those goals. So you could grow food to sell in the market or have sustainable timber for housing construction or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to meet conservation goals. And then your land becomes, it's privately owned land that functions like a nonprofit. And then I learned that part of the requirement of applying for one of these is you have to become part of a directory. So there's a national network of them. And there are more than 800 in existence in Colombia, more than 800 privately owned and managed nature reserves.
Hmm.
And all of a sudden, I knew how to take this walk through the land that we were doing. It was either we buy land and turn it into nature reserves, or we enter into partnerships with private landowners and help them to set up nature reserves on their own land.
Hmm.
And then we can create networks of nature reserves that are connected by the ecology, the connectivity of the landscape itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then this abstract idea became very concrete.
Mm.
And we're going to use the money that we raise to buy land that will be owned by the foundation
mm-hmm.
that can set up nature reserves and create community reforestation and water security projects. And we're not going to buy very much land. Land is expensive in Barichara. And even if we could buy the land, it would be a bad idea because we couldn't steward a huge amount of land.
Mm-hmm.
But if we work with the local campesinos, the country farmers that are here, we can help them to become stewards of their own land.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden, it's much more clear what to do.
Yeah.
And now we're creating the foundation, we've established a fund, we've started fundraising, we're negotiating 2 land purchases, and we've been invited to walk more and more of the land.
Okay.
2 days ago, we got a message from someone out of the blue and said, help, my neighbor has 67 hectares of land. 67 hectares is a lot. This is a big piece of land. And they're starting to cut down the trees in this beautiful area of forest. And they want to divide it into lots and sell it to build a bunch of houses. Can you help us?
Hmm.
2 hours later, we're riding our bikes out into the countryside to go visit and walk on this land. And so, so what it feels like is the land is inviting us to help it. That's mm-hmm. the way it feels.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because we have a clear understanding of how to help the land.
Yeah. Well, I mean, something that came up, and I'm just curious what your thoughts are. I mean, we're talking about decolonizing the land and our way of our relationship to the land. But I'm curious, because I mean, you are someone from North America, and you're coming down to South America, and you want to engage in these, I think, really important and very beautiful ideas. But how are like people that are like there responding to you from basically an outsider coming in and like engaging in these this type of work? I mean, how has that been navigated for you, where you're being very sensitive to the people that are, you know, from there, that are indigenous to that area, you know? And I'm just curious, like, how do you navigate that kind of, it seems like a complex thing, or maybe it's not, maybe it's less complex than I think it is, but how do you navigate that?
I think it's a very subtle and very important thing.
Yum, yum.
And
what kind of fruit is that, by the way?
Thank you. That's a type of plum.
Oh, okay.
Almost like an apricot. Mm.
Because it's not ready.
Yep, it's a little sour. It still tastes good to me. Mm. And so this question is actually of fundamental importance. And there are a couple of aspects to it that I can start to unpack, and we won't cover all of it because it's just a really big topic.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing is that the indigenous people were driven to extinction 300 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were completely wiped out in this region. They were also the last stronghold and the most fierce resistance against the conquistadors.
Mm.
And so so it's a very interesting place. There is some of the culture that is still present here. Like I have, I can even show you, I have to walk and get it, I'll show you a traditional textile of the indigenous people here, because I just bought one made by a local craftsman.
Mm.
But so you can see that some of the culture is still here. See this here, this is called a mochila, which is just like a hand satchel.
Hmm, yeah.
And it's made from a plant called fique, hmm. which is in the same family as, it's in the agave family, like what they use to make tequila.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And they make these beautiful, this is a very strong fiber, and it's a bag that can hold a lot of weight and won't break.
Hmm.
So there is this very strong craft knowledge here, and some of it is indigenous.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is from the indigenous people. And it's possible that some of the indigenous blood, you know, the genetic line is still mixed in with some of the local people, although it's really hard to know. But we don't really have that conflict of being on an occupied land with the occupied people still here.
Mm.
Instead, what we have is land that is a mix of country people, campesinos who have been here for several generations, and people who are from somewhere else. So whether they're from the city like Bogota and they're Colombians, or they're like me from the United States, is not really that different.
Right, right.
We're just not, you know, the local name of people here is Pati Amarillo, which means yellowfoot. Because if you walk barefoot, the color of the clay makes your feet yellow here.
Hmm.
So the Pati Amarillos, the locals, would say that we're all, you know, extranjeros or people from the outside. If they're people from the city.
Mm.
But this is a very open-minded place, a very honest and earnest place, a lot like the Midwestern United States in that sense. It's very direct, and if you're a person who's trustworthy, people figure it out pretty quickly,
right,
and they treat you well.
Mm-hmm.
But the local people actually have a really big problem with trust and are always trying to cheat and lie and steal to each other. And it's very clan-based here. So if you're part of one family, you're going to be opposed by another family because there was a feud. You know, think Hatfield and McCoys is a local version of that here in the culture among the country people.
Interesting.
It can be difficult to get them to cooperate depending on the area. Some areas they cooperate extremely well and others they cooperate really poorly. But what's interesting is I'm not coming here as someone from the United States. I'm coming here as someone from Earth who used to be part of an indigenous culture in the Mediterranean, where my family was for a long time after leaving Africa. And I am a person I am a descendant of an extinct indigenous culture.
Yeah.
And so somewhere back in history, I was part of an indigenous group because every human being is.
Yeah.
And so I've approached this place with a very powerful but very delicate way of framing things. And that is the idea of the future indigenous. The future indigenous are the people who become ancestors of indigenous people who come later. And future indigenous, you know, these are the people who learn how to live sustainably in a place and then have children and grandchildren, and the lineage continues, or at least the cultural lineage continues. It doesn't necessarily have to be bloodline specifically, because it's more cultural than genetic. And the idea of the future indigenous is it's the people who become kin to land. If I become kin to this land, then I am as though I were indigenous to this place. See, it's a very subtle topic, a subtle concept. Mm-hmm. It's one that can be very easily misunderstood. And it's also not a single generation phenomenon. So it's not like, oh, well, Joe arrived and helped build the forest, so now he's indigenous. No, it's not how it works. But it might be that part of the culture that emerges from these reforestation projects becomes an indigenous culture. And then I will be part of the formation of an indigenous culture along with a lot of other people. And so the way that I'm being received by locals is this blend of deep gratitude. They see me as though I'm a campesino because they see me, you know, taking a pickaxe and taking a machete and going and doing manual labor work and getting dirty and having, you know, I look like a campesino. I'm wearing the dirty clothes, got the hat. I'm out there working and coming back sweaty. I don't look like a city person. You know, I grew up on a farm in Missouri. I'm a country person, the campesino from somewhere else. so they see that. Some people see me as, the indigenous people here were called Guane, the Guane people. And the Guane people are the ones who went extinct. And so I sometimes have people who call me Guane man, which is funny because we've only been here a year. And it's because I'm really trying to understand and learn from the indigenous way of the Guane people. And so so you see that it's not like I became indigenous.
Right.
I didn't name myself this, but a couple of local people have started calling me this because they appreciate the way that I'm trying to discover the indigenous way of life here.
Right.
And so there's that. Then there are the other people who are from here, who are campesinos from here, but totally are weticos, meaning they are totally people who swallowed the poison of the sick conquest culture of colonialism. And because they own land here, they have played the land speculation game. And now, like, you might have a 70-year-old campesino man who owns 50 properties. So he owns 2,000 hectares of land. And he's just wealth hoarding everything. He's just a total parasitic extractor of the whole landscape. But those are local people.
Right.
So who's to criticize me for having been born on another continent if I come here with the mindset of appreciating the indigenous? And here are some local people who have this mindset. And so, and these people only understand money and they only understand narcissism. They only care about themselves and nothing else.
Right.
And you can see it, it's very clear. These are classic, like, psychopathic capitalists.
Right, right.
Who happen to have dark skin and speak with a thick local accent, and they're fifth-generation campesinos.
Right.
And so this is part of the reality of the situation, is that it's just very complex and multifaceted.
Right. Well, I get that, and I respect everything you're saying. I totally understand. I just was curious about this just seems like a somewhat complex thing, but it's also very simple, because it is really just about what you're there for, why you're there, why you've chosen to be there, and how you choose to participate in this. And I think it's like people can see that, you know, it becomes very obvious why you're there and what you're there to do. And I think that becomes very apparent. And you know, and you did touch on things already, like about just like how you're, like what you're basically doing there. And I think you said earlier about how, you know, if we talked a year ago, we would be talking about things in a much more abstract way. But now that you're like there, your feet are on the ground and you're working with it yourself, it's like, it's much more intimate, personal. And it's not as abstract. And that's something I wanted to ask more about, because I don't know if I've said this already, but we talked about, like, almost every time we talk, it always seems to be about this almost global perspective on things, like how the coronavirus fits within a broader planetary collapse or whatever. But I was just really curious about, like, what you're doing in Barichara and how, my question would be, like, what are the specific things that have degraded the landscape there? Like, what are the specific challenges that you and others that you're working with have right now in regenerating that particular bioregion? And, like, how, like, not only that, but, like, what are you doing to deal with that? But, like, how does that fit into the bigger kind of picture as well? Because I think a lot of people are wanting to do work like this, and don't really know where to even begin, you know, like, what are, like, those first steps that need to be taken to even, do they have to go to Colombia to do that? Do they have to go, you know, I know every context is different, and you have to deal, like, you just talked about the bureaucracy side of this a little bit, so each place is going to be different in regards to that, but, yeah, I guess I just, what are the specific challenges that you're facing right now, on the land that you're currently working with?
Yeah, let me give a brief history of the land.
Okay.
And I'll keep it brief, but at least to give some context. So this is a place where three mountain ranges run parallel to each other. And we are on a plateau, what they call in Spanish a mesa, relatively flat, elevated section of land that has rivers on three sides. So okay. Three deep valleys. And then there's a river system running across the top of the plateau,
okay,
which is where the 15 tributaries are. And the whole thing is about, you know, 50 miles by 50 miles is, you know, the size of this area, which is 500,000 hectares of land. And what's interesting about this place is that it used to be primarily forest, and specifically tropical dry forest, which is that there's a distinct dry season, a distinct wet season. It's a migratory corridor of connection for animals moving from one region to another. And it has incredible biodiversity. So this is an area that has high endemism, which means the types of animals and plants that live here don't exist anywhere else on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, more than 70% of the plants and animals that are here don't exist anywhere else.
Wow.
So with the destruction of the forest, there has already been an extinction event.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back maybe 80 or 90 years ago, they started cultivating food crops, cutting down the forest to grow beans and squash and corn and sort of typical Mesoamerican food crops. And then about 50 years ago, it shifted to tobacco, growing a lot of tobacco,
mm-hmm,
which is really intensive on the soil, which fills it with salts, which drains it of nutrients. And then afterwards, as of about 40 years ago, big tobacco left. There is still some tobacco here, but not on the scale that there was for this big pulse of industrial activity. And the land was so degraded at this point that the only thing left to do is drop a couple of goats or a couple of cows on it, which of course increases the erosion, compacts the soil into clay. There's already no topsoil left just about anywhere in the territory. Mm-hmm. And it's 98% deforested.
Wow.
So the forest is almost entirely gone. There are trees, but there's not forest. Mm-hmm. So that's just a little of the history and a little sense of the type of landscape that it is. Mm-hmm. So the kinds of challenges we face now are that Barichara is a beautiful, like 16th century Spanish villa. And so it's a tourist destination.
Yeah, I can
see it's them. On the Registry of National Monuments for Colombia as a town. And it has 80% of its economy is tourism. We talked about this with the collapse of tourism during COVID, mm-hmm. which started in March. And so let me tell you what happened when they opened tourism up in September. Is that we had chronic water scarcity. Mm-hmm. And then it started raining for 6 months. And so there wasn't water scarcity until in the first week of September, they allowed tourism to open again. And all of the hotels and hostels opened. And within 3 days, all of the residents were having water shortages in our houses because all the hotels were filling their swimming pools. And so there's a lot of corruption and mismanagement of water. The water that is used for the town comes from a surface reservoir where they dammed the river, mm-hmm. which effectively killed the river. Whereas historically, before the early 1990s, when they built the privatized water treatment system, which doesn't really work very well, all of the houses in town got their water from little like stone circle wells in their courtyards, mm-hmm. and they use buckets and pull the water out. So they used to get groundwater to feed the town. But now we have chronic water shortages because the groundwater supply for those wells was contaminated when they created the privatized water treatment system. Mm-hmm. So now we have this water problem. Mm. And the biggest threats to the land that we have right now are that people from the outside want to escape the city after being stuck in their apartments during COVID. Mm-hmm. And so there's sort of like a gold rush of housing. What happens is people here cut down all the trees and take a bulldozer and make the land flat, which just ecologically destroys everything. And then they divide it into parcels and sell lots. Mm. And then people from the city can come and buy houses or build houses on these lots. Now, the problem is that so many people have done this that there are probably 500 pieces of land for sale. You drive everywhere and there's for sale signs all over the countryside. Mm. And these people are destroying the land thinking they're going to sell it, but they might not sell any of it. Just destroying what remains for the possibility. It's just land speculation, classic land speculation.
Well, that was what you mentioned earlier with the land you were looking at, where the person currently owning it is just chopping down trees, just anticipating that that's what the developers or whoever would purchase it would want. And you're coming in like, hey, you know, let's not do that. Maybe I'll come in and maybe we can work something out. But yeah, that's interesting. Okay. So the issue seems to be around water. That seems to be a big part of the problem. Like, is that an accurate assessment?
Water. I would say water is the unifying need. Everyone in the territory needs water.
Right.
And so we can organize cooperation around water. The other thing is that the land speculation is a huge problem. And so there are several elements to this that are interesting. One of the interesting elements is that there are a lot of people who would like to buy ecological houses that are in the forest. Mm-hmm. But the local people here don't understand this. And so we're actually, I've started talking with some locals about creating a green real estate company. Mm. Like, who in town would like to be a real estate agent Because what's happening right now is we have several friends here who are Colombians that have other friends from the city, because they're Colombians from the city. And their friends from the city are calling them and saying, I would like to buy land in Barichara and move there. Can you find me some land? I'd like something with trees. I'd like to protect the forest. You see, it's like this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have four different friends who have told me that they're just getting like, you know, last weekend, six of my old friends called and asked me if I could help them find land to buy. They would buy it sight unseen. Just if I tell them it's good, they'll buy it.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea now is, if people are going to buy the land anyway, and we don't have the money to protect the land otherwise, then what if we could organize the buyers, people who want to buy land, and organize them into a network of forest reserves?
Mm. Right.
Like where they can have a house on 1 hectare or 2 hectares of land and surround it with native forest.
Hmm.
And then we don't cut down the forest to build their houses. We build their houses into the existing trees. Mm-hmm. We put it among them. We do an ecological assessment.
Mm. Yeah.
And what this basically means is we could do like permaculture landscape design to help identify the best site for a house if a house is going to be placed there anyway.
Right.
See, so it's just it's taking a problem we can't stop. And, you know, and in permaculture, there's this principle that says the problem is the solution. If the problem is speculative real estate, then let's try to turn it into speculative green real estate in the places where we don't have any other options.
Mm-hmm.
I don't consider this the number one priority for what to do here. But some of this land is very expensive, like $25,000 a hectare.
Mm.
And so this is not, a lot of Colombia is really cheap. This is one of the most expensive places in Colombia outside of the cities. And so so we have to have really creative ways to deal with this. But this is just an example of how there's this very serious problem. And it might turn out that recruiting people who want to build ecological homes to land that's going to be sold anyway is a way of protecting the forest in those places.
Yeah.
So it also shows you the flexibility we have to not be ideological.
Yeah.
But to just be very pragmatic and say, what is the best way to protect the forest, the best way to maintain ecological connectivity, the best way to build a culture of stewardship for the land?
Yeah. Yeah, this is a theme that's come up for me recently. I did an interview with some documentary filmmakers, Joshua Probanek and Melissa Troutman, and they made a film called Invisible Hand, and they were documenting the rights of nature movement in the United States. So people that are communities, really, communities of people, particularly a lot of them are in like Pennsylvania, as well as I think the city of Toledo, Ohio. They've tried to come up with, they're trying to use the legal framework to give rights to nature. And they completely acknowledge the limitations of that, because they, one thing they come up against over and over and over again is that the legal system of the United States is not designed to benefit communities or the natural world. But nonetheless, there have been some gains that have been made in particular contexts where towns, communities have come together and have, you know, it takes years and years of legal, that's legal battles that have come up over and over again, where they're fighting against like fracking companies and other fossil fuel industries and big agricultural corporations and things like this that are, you know, just dumping like runoff into Lake Erie, for instance, and, you know, polluting and toxifying the water. But yeah, like the whole point of that was just that documentary and that discussion with them was just to say, like, this is one tool in the toolbox. Like, if it works, it works. If not, then we have to consider other options.
Yeah, responding to what you're saying, I think part of this is cultivating a mindset of regeneration. The mindset of regeneration is about learning to be part of the landscape, learning how to be part of the ecosystems, and healing yourself and your relationships with others by having healthy relationships to the land.
Mm-hmm.
Or the other way around, build healthy relationships with yourself and others, and then learn that it's the same thing as building a relationship with the land.
Mm-hmm.
And in this way of being, it's not just a way of thinking, it's deeper than that. It's a way of being. There are pathways that are journeys of development, journeys of maturing, journeys of sophistication. And so we don't, you know, go into an area and say, there's 500 hectares of land here and we're just going to reforest it all. It's like, well, it's got a bunch of private land. A lot of it's been deforested. People are building hotels on it. There's not enough water for those hotels. It's not realistic at all to say you're just going to put a forest on it. But what is realistic is to start to change the pattern of thinking. Even if you just start in one little place, or two little places, or just go out and talk to people and find out who already has the mindset and organize them. And it's just this way of seeing that what we're doing is encouraging an evolutionary process so that we can work with what is already present in the environment that we're working in. That is like a seed kernel or an element of what we want to have here in the future.
Right.
And as we do this, we just sort of chip away at it. We keep going because this is the work of multiple generations. And here the big challenge is that the type of land system change that happened in the past, turning the native forest into hard packed clay with the occasional tree, is an environment that becomes a desert. When it rains hard, the water runs off, it carries what remaining soil there is, and it dries it out further and further until it's a desert. So to reverse that is to regrow the forest and the understory of the forest, the bushes and the shrubs and the grasses and the vines and all of that, all the levels of the forest, and then connect them to each other. And if we know that's our job, like as one of my friends here described it, he said, if you were playing the Chinese game of Go, we would organize all of our pieces along the connections of water and the land. We'll play Go along the connections of water and the land. And as we do that, what happens is we see that there are already projects in the land connected to water. So we connect them to each other by gathering the people who are doing the projects. And then we try to create projects that literally connect them by talking to the people who have the land in between, who have the ability to manage and make decisions on that land. And we increase the connectivity over time. And so it's not about having an ideologically pure approach. It's about having an ecologically realistic approach.
Right. Yeah, it's like every context is different. Every place is going to be different. You may have an overarching ideal scenario that you're going for, but every place is going to require different things, and different types of energy has to be put into making certain things possible, and connections have to be made. And like, you're working with, like, I'm just thinking of like the bureaucratic side of it, something I hate so much, like of anything. I hate that so much, like viscerally. Like even just doing like basic things involving like going to like the DMV or something, you know, just like really little things. But like not only to do that, but then to go to another country and you have to like, okay, is there a parallel to what I'm used to up in North America or in the United States here? How do I navigate that? You know, I'm sure you're pretty fluent right now, I imagine, at this point in Spanish, but just like getting to even that point of like understanding not just Spanish, but like the legals, the use of Spanish in a legal context, like all of those things. Like when I look at that, like my brain immediately go to like all of those things are like one giant like boulder that I have to figure out how to push up a hill. But you're like, no, actually, these are a bunch of little parts, and you just kind of have to. You can pick each part up at a little bit at a time, and you'll finally kind of get there. And it may take actually, maybe Elise, maybe your daughter's going to pick this up, and she'll be the one to carry a big part of that, or like her children, or whoever. I mean, anybody else that comes into the picture is going to help carry this forward. And it's good to remind. I have to remind myself of those things all the time. Otherwise, I am paralyzed. Like I just don't do anything. And I want to like crawl in a hole and not think about it anymore. But, you know, a very much more healthier way of approaching it is to kind of take it a little bit at a time and recognize like, yeah, not to be so ideologically pure about all of these things and just knowing what's needed right now and how it can be done. And that's a very, I think, a very immature and healthy way to approach this type of situation.
And also, something I've been practicing in the last month as an act of meditation is what it means to have devotion.
Mm.
Now, devotion is where you commit daily acts of commitment to something you care about. And I started doing this because I teach capoeira classes, you know, the martial art capoeira.
Yeah. Yeah.
I teach it three times a week on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, 7 o'clock in the morning in front of one of the stone churches here in town. There's a little, you know, stone patio area in front of it. And what I started doing was just, there are two city workers. Oh, you have a slug on your finger? Oh, nice. Hey, saw a slug.
Oh, hi. Showing a little slug.
And so there are two city workers that keep brooms. They hide them in a tree in front of the church. So then they come there to do other work. They just grab one of these brooms out of the tree and sweep with it.
Hmm.
So what I started doing was, before my capoeira class, I just arrived 10 minutes early and I sweep that area. Because this is also a really popular place that tourists come to and take their picture in front of the church.
Hmm.
Well, what I've noticed is, since I started sweeping that little patio area three times a week, is even this last weekend was Christmas weekend, the biggest pulse of tourists we've had yet. And there was no garbage left in front of the church.
Hmm.
Because I am caring for it on a regular, every 2 or 3 days, I'm sweeping it. It is visibly cared for when someone enters into it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people feel that, and then they take care of it by putting the trash in the garbage.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before I started doing this, there was garbage everywhere, and I was picking up garbage before I would teach my capoeira classes. And so the simple act of devotion is about picking something to do that reminds yourself of what you care about.
Mm-hmm.
And then it has an effect on others.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's really powerful.
It is very powerful. Yeah. Well, Joe, I want to ask, this is really kind of the last thing I want to cover. I mean, I'm just so happy we can catch up, and I'm happy to see you. Just, I don't know. Like right now, I mean, people that might be listening, I'm probably releasing some video of this too, if you don't mind, but I can actually like see where I think this is your home, where you're living. It's just really beautiful. And you're, you know, just kind of running around, and I could see all the plant life and your daughters running up and like showing you stuff. It's just, I don't know. It's pretty, it's beautiful. But I want to talk about the Varichara Regeneration Fund that you have now. And just to talk about that, like what are the goals of that? Like, what are you trying to accomplish with that? Like, what are the funds being raised for specifically? And, you know, just how people can contribute to what you and others are doing there right now.
Yeah, the idea here is that there are two parts to this, really. One is that currently there are not any sustainable economies on Earth.
Yeah.
Well, aside from some indigenous cultures that have kept themselves relatively separate from globalization.
Hmm.
They remain sustainable, but they're in threat where they still exist.
Mm-hmm.
And they will not last the night, so to speak, if they are not actively protected. As we see with Bolsonaro in Brazil,
yes.
What they're doing with the indigenous people in the Amazon. So one thing that we need is we need a demonstration and also a laboratory, because we have to learn how.
Mm.
How do we transition an extractive economy into a regenerative economy? How do we do that? And this is a question that every place on Earth needs to answer for themselves.
Right.
And so this Varichara Regeneration Fund is a way of creating a transition pathway for an economy to change over. And it's sort of a big thing. To say that. That's a very big deal. It's very complex.
Yeah.
The other part of this is that we need a way of organizing the territory so that it can evolve itself into a regenerative economy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's mostly about learning. That's mostly about education. How do the people living here learn how to be this way?
Mm-hmm.
So already we've raised about $18,000 for this fund, and our fundraising goal is $500,000. So okay. We're trying to raise a fairly significant amount of money.
Yeah.
I'll explain why it's at that size in a moment. And one of the first things we're doing is hiring some mapping experts to construct really detailed maps of the territory and its ecological connectivity.
Okay.
So that we can start to set priorities around how to use the fund to create patterns of landscape restoration and patterns of economic activity that preserve or enhance this connectivity. So like there's an ecological corridor, let's do reforestation in it. Or here's a drainage basin, let's restore the water supply in it.
Mm-hmm.
We organize around the landscape. So this is one of the pieces of what this fund does. Another thing is that it's a portfolio of projects. So instead of investing in one project, you have an ecosystem of projects.
Mm.
But they're organized around this map. They're organized around this connectivity.
Okay.
So we're looking at the health of the entire landscape, the entire local economy, by building a portfolio of projects and connecting them to each other across the landscape.
Mm.
So this is another piece. A third piece, and part of the reason why the fund is set at a what I would say is a relatively high amount, even though I don't think $500,000 is very much money at all to build a regional economy.
Yeah.
And that is that there are some pieces of land that need to be purchased to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
One piece of land we're looking at right now is a 10-hectare piece of land. It will cost us about $100,000 to buy it. And we see it as the place of creating an ecoversity, which is an alternative university for developing a sustainable regional culture.
Mm.
There's a network of ecoversities, and we would join that network.
Okay.
And so the idea is to structure the fund so that about 80% of the money is used for land acquisition, to buy land and protect it, where we have a foundation that owns the land, and we develop community projects for reforestation and water security. And the other 20% of the money is for education projects and programs that support this mission. And the way that we see this is we've created a list of criteria for the fund. And our list of criteria will allow us to identify priorities for the territory at the level of landscape. Like, here's an aquifer system that needs to be protected. Here's an area of forest that needs to be connected together because it's fragmented. Mm-hmm. Or things like this,
mm-hmm.
you know, using the mapping that we're doing. And then what we do is we invite proposals directly from members of the community that are aligned with the goals of this work.
Okay.
And then we create as little bureaucracy as possible to just directly give the money to the local people.
Okay, yeah.
And so an example is there's a part of the territory that's already organized 14 farms that are coffee plantations. Where there's one location that when they trim all the branches from their trees, they bring the branches to one place and they do large-scale composting and biochar and other things that build really healthy, rich soil. And then it's redistributed back to the 14 farms.
Mm.
And it's just a community project that doesn't cost anyone any money and it benefits all of these businesses for 14 farms. Well, if another part of the territory wanted to create a composting system like this, then they might apply for funding to go and visit this part of the territory and learn about it, but maybe hire a person, just pay for their living expenses, like, you know, $200 a month for a year to pay a local campesino to manage the composting project for 15 of their neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Where they organize 15 neighbors around building the soil in the area where all of their land is. And so the idea of this fund is that we co-create with the people in the community. We co-create ways of bringing the native forest back and protecting it, increasing water security. And a third element that's hidden but is actually the most important is developing the complex knowledge and the emotional feeling of stewardship, the conscience, for how to use all of the native plants to create a local economy.
Because mm-hmm.
there are some plants that are used for building construction, others that are used for textiles and baskets and clothing, others that are used for medicine, others that are used for food. I like the economy. I told you before the Guane, the name of the local people is the Guane people. If you translate Guane into English, the word means tree. They were the tree people.
Mm.
This is a place that had a forest economy. So we want to build a forest economy that is local and resilient. And so that's what the fund does locally. But it also does something else, because we have Earth Regenerators, which is a digital platform with 2,300 members. So the other thing we're doing is we're creating a living laboratory for how to design a bioregion that is designed to be a bunch of education. So people from around the world can come here and learn with us. They can volunteer, and they can come and do research if they're graduate students. They can come and do work study and participate in projects. And the fund will help us do things like rent a house with several bedrooms, so that when guests come, they don't pay rent while they're here. So they have free room and board while they're coming and volunteering. So this fund enables a way of learning that anyone in the world can participate in, either by taking learning from online webinars and online design courses, where the things we're doing here become part of what's given to those online programs, or they physically come here and participate in it and help make it happen as a way of learning. And so this is what we see for this fund. Is it is a learning laboratory where we figure out how to make the transition from an extractive economy currently based in tourism to a regenerative economy based in maintaining the native forest. And we partner with other territories around the world to share what we're learning and to learn from them. So that we build up this planetary scale network of bioregional learning, so that as many places as possible can figure out how to do this. And so there are two ways that people can support, well, actually there are three ways people can support the fund right now.
Okay.
One is there's a link on GoFundMe, and they can just donate money, which is a beautiful thing to do and is very welcome. A second thing is that we are soon going to start targeted fundraising for land-based projects. Like, here's a piece of land we want to buy. It's an expensive piece of land. So we're going to build an investment package with different kinds of contributions. Like, we might ask for zero interest loans for 2 or 3 years that we pay back later, or other like combinations that are more than just donations. And so we'll have targeted ways of doing this, and people can participate in creating those or supporting those. And then the third is that we have a work group for how to create this fund that currently has about 30 people in it. And anyone who wants to can join the work group and learn with us while we're doing it by helping us to do it. And they do that by joining Earth Regenerators. And then we have a subgroup called Earth Regeneration Fund. They join that group. In that group, the Bodhichara Regeneration Fund is the prototype. It's where we're learning how to create a fund for the entire Earth, bioregion by bioregion, starting with this one. And so these are three ways that people can get involved. And then as people do get involved, they can start to do things like decide that they should come here and visit or volunteer and come and do some work with us, which is also very welcome.
Right.
So I guess that's a fourth way that people can be involved. So these are all things that people can do. And we're figuring out how to do this. Like, the way I see this is a grand challenge that needs to be solved. The only way to solve it is with cooperation. And a lot of places need this solution. And the way that we figure out how to do it is by doing it somewhere first.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to do it here.
Yeah, you're doing it. I can tell. I can see it happening.
Yeah, we're in it. We're all over it.
Yeah.
And so that's the Bodhichara Regeneration Fund.
Okay.
And if anyone goes to the you know, if you include the link with the podcast, if you go to the link, there's a description of the project, and at the bottom is a list of further readings, and there are about 15 links there. So you can sort of dive into your heart's content, tell as much as you want about the project.
Yeah.
And those further readings. I've already organized them for people.
Well, you're also providing updates on like just for the sake of transparency, like, this is what we're already doing with the funding. This is what we're going to be doing here in the next week or next couple weeks or a few months or however long. Like, you're really, really transparent, as far as I can tell, at least, to, like, you know, this is how the funds will be used. And like, you all know, like, you know, what we're doing with it. So I think that that's another element, is you're really good about keeping people updated on that too. That's what I was saying.
Yeah, I've been writing progress reports once a week, and we have enough stuff happening that we need to write one once a week.
Right.
And we might slow it down to once every 2 or 3 weeks or a month after a little while. But
right.
But for right now, it's really important because all of this is about learning how to do it. So it's not just, do you trust us to do what we say, which is also very important. It's more, learn how to do this with us. We're going to document all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'm really happy you're doing this. It's just, again, it's just good to see how much, I don't know, just like seeing where you've gone and how your family has progressed on this journey. And yeah, you're just doing it. It's just so, I feel so happy to see you do it. And that people can also like participate in this as well. Like this isn't just like a hero's journey of Joe, like taking on, you know, it's like,
no way, not yeah. possible.
Yeah, no, it's like, I could tell you're part of a community. You're like, you're building something, you're helping build something here. So it's really, really beautiful, encouraging. And just being able to catch up with you every several months and just see like, remember the very first time we spoke, you were in Portland about to leave for Costa Rica. And then I think the second time I spoke with you was you were in Costa Rica, and then things didn't quite pan out the way they were meant to or however. And then there was a little bit of this back and forth, but then you eventually resettled or settled in Barichara and with your family. And so that's where you are now. And it just seems like things are kind of clicking and connecting there. So I'm really happy to see that happening with you.
Yeah, no, thank you. Because I know we talked about this in earlier conversations that, and you were the one who named it, is there's this invisible movement. No one even knows it's there.
Yeah.
And what's happening now, and we talked about this when we talked earlier this year, that it is becoming visible. Mm. And COVID definitely helped make it visible. So now what's happening, and what I'm encouraging is my message to people who ask for my advice in this moment, is spend the next year exploring how to change your life to be part of this regenerative movement, because there's no time left.
Yeah.
We need people doing this all over the planet. And so those who are considering making deep changes, if you thought transportation was difficult this year with COVID, just wait, it's going to get worse. And so if you're going to relocate, relocate soon and find where your home is.
Yeah.
If you're not relocating, then make your home really your home.
Right.
And this next year is really important for a lot of people to do some deep soul searching and experimentation, some exploration of how to make these changes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I want to just also say before we go, I mean, that, first of all, I completely agree. Like that really, that really landed with me. That's how I feel. There's this sense of, there's this sort of sick thing that's happening now that COVID's kind of coming. It's, I mean, it's really bad in the US. It's been kind of unrelenting and, you know, there's been very little done to actually stem its spread or anything like that, but, which is a whole other conversation. But, you know, this idea we have a vaccine that's on the way and it's starting to be released and that we'll just kind of go back and everyone's just craving the sense of normalcy that existed before the pandemic hit. But like something that's been very clear to me over the past several months is whatever happens, yeah, you know, this will subside, but this is just a precursor. And we need to kind of get our heads around the fact that this is a big wake up call for like what's currently unfolding right now. And yeah, and I guess I just want to point to your book that you wrote, and that is on the Earth Regenerators website. I just want to say first real quick that it is earth-regenerators.mn.co. That's the site to go to. But your book is just up there. You have this really excellent thing that you've written called The Design Pathway. And I was reading, I haven't read all of it yet, but it's really compelling. And I mean, you basically lay out exactly like how we've come to this point and what needs to be done and how really there is no time. Like this is the time to do something. Like you find your home and you work on building a regenerative culture where you are at, however that can be done. You know, this is the time to make those big decisions to decide where to go to do that, if that's where you live currently or you need to go to wherever, you know, you feel called to go to do that. And I think I just really, it really sunk in when I was reading your book about just how many thresholds that we've already crossed, planetary thresholds. You know, I get reminded of that every time I get ready to interview you again. You know, it's just like, oh yeah, we have already crossed so many thresholds, and yet there's still so much that can be done right now in light of that. So yeah, I will be putting a link to that book as well, because it's free and you have it available for everybody to read. So
yeah. Please do. I feel like that book is a gift from Gaia to Gaia. Like, the intelligence of the earth is, I am an embodiment of the intelligence of the earth. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that in an egotistical way, because all of us are, but
yeah.
But I spent 15 years building up a perspective in service to the ecological crisis. And that book captures it in narrative form. And mm-hmm. the earth needs its earth needs her humans to get that message.
Yeah.
So it's not like Joe the prophet. No, Earth the prophet is galvanizing her servants. And those of us who care for our great mother, who gave birth to all life on this planet, we are doing what we can do.
Yeah.
And that book is an invitation into sharing the grief and the trauma together, mm-hmm. and finding that there is a real pathway. There is something we can really do. And it's not bullshit stuff like electric cars or colonies on Mars. This is the real pathway. And there are a lot of us already doing it. There are a lot of elders who are doing it even before I was born. So it's not like I'm articulating something new, but it's really articulating where we are and what it means to be here to do what comes next.
Right.
And what comes next is like a 50-year to 200-year process.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
So I'm not talking about what to do next month. I'm talking about what to do for the rest of your life.
Right.
And so that's the invitation for this. And I think the book, I've heard a lot of positive feedback that the book does that well.
Yeah. Well, I'll be sure to link everybody to the fund, to the GoFundMe, and also to the website, and people can read your book, learn more about the Earth Regenerators. And all of that, and like you said, with the GoFundMe, there is a lot of information. I was reading about it yesterday, so definitely, like, a lot of information you just have out there. If anybody has any questions, I think most of those questions could probably be answered with just a bit of research and just reading what's available that you've provided. So, yeah, Joe, thank you so much. Thanks for catching up with me. I'm just so happy to see where you're at right now. It's really warms my heart. It sounds kind of cheesy, but I just feel happy to see, like, where you've gone and what you're doing now. So thank you for talking to me.
No, thank you for witnessing my change, because we're just in such a better place than we were. We were in a really dark place for like 10 years,
yeah.
My wife and I.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so we feel really good to be in this place. It feels lovely to be here.
Yeah.
And lovely to be seen by our friends. So thank you for seeing us.
Yeah, of course.